Introduce our main speaker for the evening, Mike A. from Casa de Oro.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a blackout drunk. Any other blackout drunks in the room? My people. You know, last time I spoke here, my wife just mentioned this. Larry Dixon asked me to speak, and Larry was the guy that married us, and he was very influential in my wife's life, and I just think it's important that he should be mentioned right now. I would like to thank everybody that has a service commitment at this meeting, helps keep this thing going. I'd like to thank Larry and Tony and the members that are that asked me to come and do this. And, you know, Tony approached me at my Tuesday night Big Book Step Study, and I said, yeah, I'd be willing. And then Larry contacted me. And, you know, I never know what I'm going to talk about when I get up to share at one of these meetings, you know, especially when I'm the main speaker. It's like, wow, I got the whole night, you know. It's like, you know, you just never know what's going to come out. I have no pre-planned pitch. I'm going to tell you what my life used to be like. What it was like at the end of my drinking, what it was like at the beginning of my sobriety, what it was like at when I bottomed out emotionally in sobriety, and what my life is hopefully like today. You know, that's my goal for the evening. My goal is not to touch the old timers. You know, you guys know how to stay sober. My goal is to touch the newcomer in the back of the room. That's where I normally sit. Because that's where most of the guys sit that don't have sponsors. You know, they're hanging out in the back of the room, you know, and they're still trying to be cool. And that's the way I was when I first got here. I was hanging out in the back of the room trying to be cool. And I got to the rooms. Before I do that, okay, I wore the coat and tie, okay? I'm taking it off. It's frickin' hot. My sobriety date is January 31st, 1992. I got here. You want me to take it all off? Right on. I got sober sometime during the month of January 1992. I don't know what my last drink was. I know what my last blackout was, but I don't know when my last drink was. And, you know, my last blackout was New Year's Eve was my last blackout of 1991. And what happened to me that night pretty much happened the first night that I got drunk. I blacked out. I got laid. And I woke up the next morning saying, what the hell happened? You know, what the hell happened? And that was, you know, that's what happened the first night that I drank. Me and a couple of friends of mine, I snuck out. I stayed the night at my friend Rocky's house, and then we snuck out and went over to Brent's house. And Brent had a 2-liter Pepsi bottle that was half full of vodka, and the three of us sat around and drank it. And we got drunk, and I ended up having sex with Brent's sister, and I was in heaven. I mean, it was like, wow, this is great, you know. But I woke up the next morning, and people told me what I had done, you know, when I was in my blackout. And I was just like, no way, you know, I didn't do that. And that's what would happen to me every time I come out of a blackout. People would tell me what I had done, and I'd be like, it would be hard for me to face the world, you know. And if you're a blackout drunk and you understand that, you know, I got here, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I got here and I knew that I drank into blackouts, but I didn't think I was an alcoholic. You know, an alcoholic, I knew what an alcoholic was. I grew up in this little town called White City, Oregon. And in White City, Oregon, they have this place called the Veterans Administration Domiciliary. In 1942, it was called Camp White. And it was trained to, it was a camp that was put there to train the Oregon militia for desert combat in World War II. And when the war ended, they dismantled the entire base, with the exception of this one little section that they kept as a hospital for the southern end of the valley where I grew up. And now it's when I was a kid growing up, it was an alcohol rehabilitation center. And when I was a kid, me and my twin brother and my sister, we'd go along this bike path that they had created because these World War II veterans and these Vietnam veterans and these Korea War veterans were walking up and down the highway, and they were getting hit by vehicles because the guy that had the grocery store right across the street wouldn't sell booze. And so these guys would walk a mile and a half up the road, and they were getting hit by trucks and by all kinds of things. So they created this bike path so that they knew they wasn't going to stop them from drinking. It's like, man, they've been trying to make us stop drinking for years, you know. But they created this bike path so that these guys wouldn't get, you know, killed. And me and my brother and my sister, we'd go collect the empty bottles and the empty cans and go cash them in and get bubble gum and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, when I was a kid growing up, you know, the alcoholic was the guy laying on that park bench that had the bottle next to him. And that's what an alcoholic was. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if being an alcoholic had to do with morals and moral values and lack thereof, you know, I wouldn't be an alcoholic, because the family I grew up in a family that had high morals, high standards. My parents made sure that I was raised right. I was taught the difference between right and wrong. I was taught not to steal, not to lie. And if I did, my dad made sure that he let me know that he was completely displeased. I was raised with the iron fist, you know. And it's funny, my mom... By the time my dad was 24, there was four kids. By the time he was 25, there was five. My mom was 22, raising five kids. And I think about that today, and it's just like, man, I see one of these little bastards running around here, I was like, kill him, you know? And I'm sure that's the way my mom felt, you know? But, I mean, it was like there was five of us, five attention deficit disorder. It's what we're labeled as today. You know, when we were kids, they were just high energy, you know. But now everybody's got a label. They're either attention deficit, ADD, bipolar, whatever, you know. But when I was a kid, we didn't have labels. It was like, you were just a kid, you know. Get outside and get that energy out and, you know, do what you got to do. But there was five of us. And my dad was a firefighter, and he'd pull a 24-hour shift. And he'd work 24 on, 24 off, 24 on, 24 off, 24 on. Then he'd have 4 days off, 96 off. And my mom was left at home with five of us. And so my dad found a real quick solution to that, and he created what was called the stick. And it was about 3 feet long. It was solid oak. And when we got out of line, my mom used it, and it kept us in check. And sometimes I wish we could use them today. if any of you are relating to that, you know. So morals were besides the beatings, you know, morals were a high standard in our home, you know. So if being an alcoholic was just a lack of morals, then I shouldn't be an alcoholic, right? I mean, do the right thing, you're honest, you're upright, you're standing, you know, you do what needs to be done, you take care of your business. And so when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I told you about my beginning of my drinking. My last blackout I ended up sleeping with someone else's wife, and bless you. And I, you know, it's not something that that I'm proud of. It's not something that, you know, I aspire to today, or even aspired to then. You know, when I found about it the next day, I was just like, man, you really got to get your shit together. 3 months prior to that, I was at a bar down in Imperial Beach. It's called Yale Plank Inn. I think it's still there. I went there a couple of years ago, and just to see, you know, and it's really improved. I mean, it's a high class bar now. I mean, Imperial Beach then was, I mean, there was just dirt parking lots all the way around it then. But this is where I reached bottom. I reached bottom November 1991. I woke up after a night drinking with the guys, and what they told me was that sometime during that night I drove my car. Drove my car back to the apartment, jumped on the motorcycle, wrecked the motorcycle on the way back to the bar, and then I went back and jumped in the car and drove it back to the bar. Anyways, it was a long night, you know? And before I go any further, I need to describe the type of vehicles that I drove then. I had this car that I was driving, it was a 1977 Grand Prix. I bought it from a guy that I worked with for $350. It was rusted out everywhere. The only reason I still drove it was because the tags were still good. It wasn't registered in my name. I had the title, but it wasn't registered in my name. There was no insurance on it. He had wrecked it, and I had bought it for the motor, but until I was ready to do something with that, I figured I'd drive it. And when he wrecked it, he just completely demolished the whole front end of the car. And the grill was all fiberglass, and it was just toast. So what I did was I went and I bought a piece of plywood, and I cut out vents for the radiator to get air to go through the... And then I cut out headlight mounts so that I could mount the headlights. And then I cut out little spots for the blinkers to go into. And then just so it would look cool, I painted the scenery where the lights were, I painted that all black. And then right where the grill was, it was orange, you know, like Harley colors, you know, black and orange. And I have no idea what I was doing, you know. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And I had five vehicles like that. I'm living in an apartment. There's four of us renting an apartment. We're paying $650 a month. And we're having a hard time making rent. And rent's only $650 a month, and to make it easier for us and for our money to last longer, we bought an old refrigerator, put a CO2 charge system into it, and bought kegs because it was cheaper to buy kegs than it was to buy bottles, and when everyone would run out, I was the neighbor I would hate to have today. I mean, oh my God, stereo blaring all hours of the night. It was just crazy. It was insane, you know, listening to AC/DC, 2 o'clock in the morning, volume at 10, you know, cops coming banging on the door. If you don't turn it down, we're going to confiscate the stereo. We're going to arrest someone. Okay, not a problem. It's not going to happen anymore. And then they come back at 3. It's like, okay, we've already come by once, you know, and that would happen every weekend. And like I said, I would hate to have me as a neighbor today, you know. November 1991, when I wrecked the motorcycle and I drove the car back to the bar, apparently some guy was picking on a dog outside the bar. And Captain Justice threw on his cape and said, I'm going to protect this dog. And I go out there and this guy shoves me and I fall and I get hit on the head, knocked me out. And when I came to, I pulled this knife, and I chased this guy around this dirt parking lot, and I was going to stick him. And when I started drinking that night, that was not part of the plan. Had never been part of the plan. That's never been a part of my plan on any night. Neither had been any part of my plan on any night to sleep with someone else's wife. Neither had it been any part of my plan to go out and fight or, you know, just do whatever else I did when I was drinking. But when I'm drinking it, yeah, it seems like a good idea at the time. So on my final blackout, I said, okay, that's it. I'm done drinking. I'm never drinking again. And I meant it. But I ended up drinking again. And what I need to tell you is that sometime during November of 1991 also, I used to like to dance, and I still like to dance. I do country line dancing. I don't line dance. I do country two-step. My wife line dances. But I used to go out. I don't even know if it's still. It used to be Magnolia Mulvaney's out in Santee. And we'd go out there dancing. One night, this lady came up to me and asked me to dance. And I said, okay. And I danced with her. You know, and I remembered her name. And that was a huge deal. I mean, for me to remember someone's name was huge. Anybody ever have a problem remembering people's names? I still have a problem with it today. Just way too much early on. Just way too much. But she asked me to dance. I remembered her name. And then I didn't see her again until probably January of 1992. And I saw her again. And I remember her name. I went up and asked her to dance. And she said, yeah. And I got her phone number. And I started chasing her. And she was trying to avoid me, I guess, at all costs, you know. But I'm a stalker, and so I got her phone number. We started hanging out. We started going to meetings. I was with her we dated for 2 weeks, and then, you know, she let me know. She said, I'm an alcoholic in recovery. I'm like, oh, okay. She asked, well, do you want to go to a meeting with me? I said, oh, okay. Had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. Had I known, 23 years later, I'd be standing up here. I'd probably do it all over again. My life is good today, you know, compared to what it was. But at the time, when I first got sober, man, it was rough. This lady was a drug and alcohol abuse counselor. She worked down in Chula Vista at one of the treatment facilities. When I was 90 days sober, we got married. Now, who do you think was sicker? The person was 6 years recovery and a drug and alcohol abuse counselor and working in a treatment facility, or the 90-day wonder, right? Anyways, we tried to make it work, you know. And this is where my recovery actually begins. You know, I'm going to meetings and I'm doing what's called meeting based sobriety. You know, and meeting based sobriety is you're going to meetings, and that's what meeting based sobriety is. You're going to meetings. That's all you're doing. You're going to meetings and you're just not drinking. And you're going to meetings and you're just not drinking. And you're going to meetings and just not drinking. And you're going to meetings and I'm just not going to drink. Right. And that's what meeting-based sobriety is. And that's what I did for a long time. I did meeting-based sobriety for 5 years. Meeting-based sobriety. I'm not drinking. Right? And that's what I would do. I'm just not going to drink. At 5 years, I ready to blow my brains out. Part of meeting-based sobriety also involves being of service, right? Not working the steps, but being of service. There's a big difference there, too. When I was 4 months sober, I went on board my first ship in sobriety. I did 20 years in the Navy. My first 9 years, I was drunk, and I went all over the world drunk. I've been to the Persian Gulf 7 times. My first 2 times, I was sober. My first 2 times I was drunk. My last 5 I was sober. The reason I wear this tie is this is the last part of my Navy uniform I still wear. Right here. That's it. When I was 5 years sober, a friend of mine in recovery, one of my guys that I was hanging out with, decided to get married. And I didn't have a jacket, and he asked me to be his best man. And this is the jacket he bought me at a thrift store. That's why I wear this. Let me go back to when I was in the military. My first ship in sobriety, I went aboard the ship and I didn't know how I was going to stay sober. I didn't know how I was going to, just not drink on a deployment where I'm on a ship where there's 3,000 guys and everybody drinks, right? And I don't want to drink. And I went to the drug and alcohol abuse counselor on board the ship, and I said, I'm new in recovery. I've got just a little over 90 days. I'd like to know if we're going to have meetings while we're on deployment. He says, as a matter of fact, we will. Yeah. He goes, you'll be the secretary. Give me a call. Let me know when you want to have the meetings, and we'll have the word passed over the announcement system on the ship, and we'll make sure that, you know, we have at least the word passed, and if people show up, then you guys can have a meeting. And I was like, oh, okay. I had no idea what I was going to do. Absolutely none. And so first night on deployment, I go to the phone and I call, and yeah, we're going to have an AA meeting on the mess decks. And the mess decks is like the cafeteria on the ship. It's the most non-anonymous spot there is on the boat. Everybody transits through and all the time, and so, you know, I announced, yeah, they're going to have an AA meeting on the mess decks. And they announced it over the ship. There's now an AA meeting on the mess decks. And four people showed up. One guy had 30 days sober. I had 4 months sober. Another guy had a year sober. Another guy had 2 years sober. And the guy with 2 years sober, his name was Chuck. The guy with 1 year sober, his name was Mike. And I forget what the guy's name was, 30 days. He didn't stay. He didn't stay sober through the deployment. There was four of us that stayed sober through the deployment. And Tim, our resident old-timer, he ended up coming after a couple of meetings. And I ended up giving him a five-year token on the boat. And we didn't have no tokens, right? It was like, he goes, yeah, my birthday is, you know, coming up. I'm going to have 5 years. And so I went to the airframe shop, and we punched out a disc of aluminum. And I had some blue spray paint, so we spray painted it blue. And I didn't have any paint brushes or anything, but I had whiteout. So we took whiteout, and we painted a triangle, and we painted a five on it, you know. And I worked on the ship. I was a cook on the ship, and I worked in the storerooms. And we ended up moving the meeting down to the storerooms, so we got him a cake, and we gave him his 5 year token. And what I can tell you about that entire the only reason I share that, right, is activity and action kept me sober. Activity and action kept me in the hunt for sobriety. Activity and action. And if I hadn't been for activity and action, I don't think I would have been sober that first deployment. I got back from that deployment, and my now ex-wife she was pregnant before I left. And when I got back, December 21st of 1992, I had a baby girl. And she is going to be 23 this year. And through a bad series of incidents, her mother and me not being able to get along or communicate, her being stuck in the middle of a war between the two of us going through the divorce, she wants absolutely nothing to do with me. And that's okay. That's okay. And I share that with you because, you know, you hear a lot of people say, you know, you keep coming to meetings and everything will be all right. Everything, you know, you get your job back, your wife back, your kids back. That's not always true. It's not. You know, I hope that someday when my daughter, you know, starts to think on her own or behave on her own, you know, she might want to contact me and find out my side of the story. And that's okay. You know, and until then, you know, I just keep hoping. I don't dwell on it, right? I share that for the newcomer in the room. You don't always get your kids back. Sometimes we do incredibly heinous things to the people in our lives. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. I mean, think about it. You know, think about all the stuff that we do when we're drinking. Crazy stuff. They say an alcoholic affects seven people. On a minimum, seven people. You know, when I look at all the people that are affected by my drinking, it's amazing I have anybody in my life. You know, my mom and dad, you know, they're in my life. I've done so much, to try and repair. I cleaned up my side of the street when we went through the divorce. When I went through the divorce is when I hit my emotional bottom in recovery. I finally decided, okay, my way's not working anymore. Time to do something else. And I had been attending Easy Desert Riders at that time for 2 years. And I asked my sponsor, Al T., if he would take me through this. He wasn't my sponsor. He was just my friend. And I would call him. I'd call him every Sunday morning at 5:30. I'd say, Al, are you going to the meeting? He goes, good morning, Michael. Yes, I am. You know? And we'd have a small little conversation. But he never pushed me away. He never said, geez, why are you calling me at 5:30 in the frickin' morning on a Sunday? You know, the meeting's in an hour and a half. I'll see you there, you know? He never said that. What he said was, good morning, Michael. How are you? How was your week? What'd you do? You know, and we started a conversation. We started a relationship. So that when my ass was falling off and I was ready to blow my brains out, I had someone that I could turn to and talk to. And that's what this deal's about. It's about when you ain't got nothing else to lose, no one else to turn to, and you're ready to die. Right? I want the hand of AA to be there. I want someone to be there for the next guy walking in. And Al was there. And he's here tonight. And he was perfect for me. He was perfect. He was an educator of junior high school children. Perfect for me. He knew exactly how to approach me. Same way he did his junior high school children. And I'll be goddamned it worked. But when I called him, he said, why don't you come over and we'll sit down and talk about it. So I went over to his house and we sat down and we talked about it. And he said, why don't you go back and pick up the book and do some reading and do some work and do an inventory. And I did an inventory and I came back to him. My first inventory, man. Before I get to the inventory, I didn't have God in my life. I didn't believe in God. God was the furthest thing from my mind. I think that's the reason why it took me so long to get to the steps, was because I was unwilling to submit my will and my life to a power greater than myself. And Al was good. He was real good. With me, what he said was, he goes, Mike, he goes, just stop. He goes, just stop. Stop. He goes, I don't believe in God. He's like, just stop. He goes, I don't want you to believe in God. He goes, what I want you to do is, he goes, I want you to go home and I want you to write a letter to God every day. He goes, I don't care what that letter says. I don't care what you write in that letter. He goes, it doesn't have to be a long letter. It can be a sentence. It can be a paragraph. But it's something I want you to start doing every day. He goes, what time you get up in the morning? At the time I was getting up at, I think, 4:30. He goes, get up at 4:15. I was just like, what? And I was like, no, get up at 4:15 and just take this time to do this. And so I set my alarm for 4:15 and I'd sit down. And at the time I was doing pen and ink and I'd start writing this letter to God. And he said, Mike, he goes, it can be as simple as this. Dear God, I don't believe that this is going to work, but my sponsor says it will. Here's your letter. And that's where it starts. And that's where it started for me. That's where my life started to change. One, knowing that I can no longer do it by myself. That's step one. I can't do this by myself. I am completely powerless. Step two, becoming willing to do something else. Right? Willing to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I became willing through action. Again, action. I became willing through action. Some people get it. I didn't. I wrote letters for a long time. And then one day, all of a sudden, I found that I wasn't writing letters for anybody else but myself and for my relationship with God. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself through that action. Step three, man, step three was good. We sat down and we went over the third step. And we didn't get on the knees and hold each other's hands and look into each other's eyes and say the prayer, you know. He goes, I don't want to feed your ego, and I don't want to feed mine. He goes, what I want you to do is pay real close attention to the next paragraph, where it says, it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. And that's important. That's real important. It's important to me, right? Because it's a God of my understanding, not a God of your understanding or anybody else's understanding. It's a God of my understanding. And so when we did the third step, we did it together, and he said, look, the only guy you have to prove anything to is the guy in the mirror. Look at the guy in the mirror, right, and talk to him about God. The fourth step, I did my fourth step. I went back to him. I had 13 people on my list. He broke the fourth step down into terms I could understand. He said, who are you pissed off at? Wow, that's a resentment. What are you afraid of? And who'd you have sex with? Wow, that's simple. And when I did my fourth step, there were 13 people on my list. That's it. That was all I could do at the time. And that was enough. And when I went to him with that list, he said, this will do. You know, my greatest fear with the fourth step was that, my whole life it had been a writing assignment, you know? It's like, hey, do this, turn in your homework, you know, and it's going to be graded, you know? And that was my fear with the fourth step, you know? I'm going to do all this work, and I'm going to turn it over to someone, and he's going to say, you did it wrong. Tear it up and give me an F and make me do it all over again, you know? And that's what I thought a fourth step was going to be like, and that's not what a fourth step was. The fourth step was for me, to look at me, right? And at the time, I was so concerned about how you were going to look at me as a result of me looking at me. It's crazy, right? It's like my fourth step was for me to find out about me. And the fourth step was simple, you know. It was. It was really simple. You start with, who am I pissed off at? And that's it. You just start with that list. Don't go into why or anything else. Just, who am I pissed off at? And you continue all the way down the line until you're done with the list of people you're pissed off at. Then you go to the next column. Why am I pissed off at them? Then you can go back and look at who you're pissed off at. Now you can look at why you're pissed off at them. Then you can go to the third column and the fourth column. By the time we got to my fifth step and my amends and six and, you know, the real change took place in six and seven for me. Six and seven step, my sponsor and me, the rest of you guys may not believe it, but are the forgotten steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. People do four and five, rush through, can they get do five, do six, seven, because it's two short paragraphs in the big book, and then boom, they go on to eight and nine. Make my list, I got part of it, and now I'm going to make my list, and I'm going to go make amends. Right? And then they just start a new fourth step because they haven't done any changing, right? The change takes place in step six and seven. That's where the change takes place, right? I'm asking God on a continual basis to help me change. Help me change who I am. Help me not be the animal that I thought I was. Right? Help me change. And that's what six and sevens are about. That's what they're about for me. They continue to be about that for me today. Help me change. Help me change. And help me look at myself. Eight and nine, my biggest amends was my ex-wife. I flew back to Massachusetts. I called her, flew back, said, I need to make amends with you. Can we go to dinner somewhere? And she said, yes. So before I went, I sat down with Al. We went over my list. I had 13 items there that I need to make amends for, one of which was being a martyr. Oh, you know? And so I made my amends, you know. And part of that amends process, you know, we're at dinner and I'm telling her, you know, I'm sorry about this and this and this. And, you know, I did this, this, and this. And when I was done, she was like, that's it? I go, yeah. And she goes, well, what about this and this and this and this and this and this and this, right? And she's got this laundry list, you know, of stuff that she wants me to make amends to her for, you know. And I said, I'm sorry you feel that way, but based on the work that I've done with my sponsor, everything that I need to make amends for you is right here. And I cleaned up my side of the street. I said, now, what do you need for the amend process? Because that's important, right? It's not just an apology. It's like, I am mending offense. How do I fix this? How do I fix this? And we still hadn't finished writing our divorce. Well, I took with me the divorce paperwork, and we had both agreed basically to everything, all the terms that were on there. But when I asked her, I said, "What do you need for this amends?" She said, "I want you to rewrite the divorce paperwork." So we sat down that weekend and we completely rewrote it. And I took it back to my attorney and I said, "This is what we've decided on." He goes, "I am not going to write this up." And I go, "It's an amends and it's something that needs to be done." He goes, "As your attorney," I said, "get it out. As my attorney, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Legally, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you've done your part. Now, make sure this happens." And my amends was taken care of with my ex-wife. Now, I'm going to tell you the freedom that I get from that, right, is when she was traveling out to San Diego to bring my daughter for visits, what would happen is she would get off the plane and she would be walking across the terminal, and the first thing she did when she saw me was she would look at the ground. I could stand there and look her in the eye. I cleaned up my side of the street. I had taken care of my side of the business, right? I was clean inside. It didn't matter how she felt about me, right? Because the amends process and the process of the steps is about my relationship with God, my relationship with my fellow man, and my relationship with you, and how I feel about myself as a result of the actions that I did in my past and the correction process that I had taken care of. And so I was clean. I was clean on the inside, and it didn't matter how she felt about me. I had taken care of my side of the street, and I could hold my head high, and I could look at her in the eye. And that's what the amends process is about. It's about freedom. How free do you want to be? I wanted to be free. I didn't want her to own me anymore. I didn't want nothing to do with her anymore, right? And I'm free. I am free. In 1999, I met my wife. I made some decisions based on ego. I went on board this ship. It was a PC. It's a patrol coastal. There's only 27 guys on board. I was the only sober member. It was designed to get SEALs in and out. It was all about special warfare, hoorah, kill, you know. And they wanted absolutely nothing that I had. Absolutely nothing, right? I'm going in there, you know, peace, love, serenity, and they're just like, you know. And they're just like, you know, I'm reading books. I'm the only sober guy on the boat, right? I'm reading spiritual literature every day, right? But I'm the only guy on the ship, and I'm on deployment, and I'm trying to maintain sobriety by myself. And I pull into a port, and I'm sleep deprived, and it was just an insane lifestyle that I was completely unaccustomed to, and I was not prepared for. And lack of sleep deprivation for extended period of time makes you go crazy, much like when you're drinking. You know, it's like, why do you think we're all crazy when we get here? Because we party until 2 o'clock in the morning, get up at 5, and go all day, and then we take a little cat nap and do it all over again. That's what I did. And so, about midway through this deployment, I went to the medical officer and I went to the executive officer, and I said, "Look, you guys have given me keys to the armory, and I'm not mentally stable right now, and I think the wisest decision you guys would be to get me off of this boat as quickly as you can, because I'm thinking about doing seriously bodily harm to other people." And that devastated my career. I mean, they're like, "Oh, you are not going anywhere." It was like completely destroyed my military career. I had aspirations of making chief and this and that and everything else. I had 3 years left. I just wanted to hang on, but I didn't want to drink. And I didn't want to do anything to hurt anybody. And so they made a decision, and they flew me out and flew me back stateside. And I immediately got back involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I immediately got back involved. I mean, my first day back, I went to a meeting at the Lemon Grove Alano Club, and there was a guy there that I used to work with at my previous command. And I got 2 minutes left. And his name was Robert, and he became my sponsee. You know, they sent me to psych. Psych wanted to put me on drugs, and they said, "We're going to put you on these psychotropic drugs and do this and do that." And I was like, "Oh, wait a minute. Let me, let's talk about that, you know? Let's talk about me taking drugs. I don't want to take drugs. Let's talk about that. So me and my doctor talked about that, but that was his first decision. I'm going to put you on drugs. He's like, no, let's talk about that. I don't want to take drugs. I said, let me get back involved working the steps with my sponsor. Let me get back involved with the works of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll see what happens. And give me at least 90 days. And he said, okay. It was a fair deal. You know, we talked about it. And 90 days later, I went back to him, and we decided that drugs really weren't what I needed. And, you know, I could have easily bought into, oh, yeah, you're right. Give me some. You know, and look for the quick fix. And I talked to my doctor. I talked to my sponsor. I got back involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got back into service of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life has changed. Because I'm willing to do the work. So, when I met my wife, we met in Laughlin, Nevada. I had taken two guys out there. Two sponsees, one of which I have no idea where he's at now, but we're going out for the convention that they hold in Laughlin, and my wife and I used to attend a lot of the meetings here in San Diego, but we'd never run into each other, and we were at the Saturday night dance, and we were introduced by a couple of friends, and she gave me the wrong phone number. But she told me where she worked, and because I am a stalker, I called her, and we've been together ever since. You know, our life is good. Our life is good. You know, she's my best friend. We've grown up together in Alcoholics Anonymous, and. No, okay. Safe. we've grown up together in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have an AA home, like she said. God, there's so many things I want to tell you. You know, the one thing that I most love about my wife is that when she gets mad at me, there's this sparkle that comes into her eyes, right? And it's just like, I just love that sparkle, right? She'll start laughing, she'll start smiling, and she'll be mad as hell, but there's that sparkle. And, you know, sometimes I think that's why I give her such a hard time all the time, so I can get to see that sparkle in her eye. I love my wife. I love my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for the life that I've been given today. If you're new in recovery, I really, really hope I shared something tonight that will help you stay sober for one more day. If you're thinking about taking a drink, get involved. Get into action. There's a big difference in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people say, oh, my program. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in this book. This is the fellowship. And this is the meeting. And the meetings will help you stay sober. But the program will change your life. Thanks for letting me share.